Welcome to the Sato Social. I'm David.
And I'm Richard.
And we're here with two guests from Conflux, which is a proof-of-work DAG hybrid chain coming out of Tsinghua University here in Beijing. So first things first, maybe you guys can introduce yourself, and then we'll move on to the project. So kind of tell us how you guys got involved and what brought you into Tsinghua University blockchain space.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys for having us. My name is Z. I am doing operations work at Conflux, and it's a pleasure, absolute pleasure to be here.
Okay, Z. Peter as well. Peter?
Yeah. Hey, everyone. I'm Peter. I'm also very happy to be here. So I'm actually a graduate student now at Tsinghua. I joined Tsinghua, the graduate program, a year ago, and I had been looking around for a long time about what's going on in China in the blockchain space in terms of more focusing on the technical aspects, the developments, like developer aspects. And that's how I found Conflux, that I joined as a core developer.
Okay.
We actually have a connection with Conflux at Sato because when I was renewing my passport in Toronto, I had a conversation with a U of T prof about blockchain. He's like, oh, you guys are from China. Are you that Conflux project? And so I looked you guys up.
You said the other one.
Yeah, no, I'm like, we're way better than them. But it's interesting. So that's when I first heard about you guys and learned what you're doing. It's an interesting approach. Do we want to go into the tech now or maybe the history of the project?
It is different enough, I think, to just ask a little bit about the logic behind the approach. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a proof of work and a DAG don't usually sit together. Yeah. I mean, it's not a common approach. So can you get a little bit in, maybe as an introduction, the inspiration for that and the logic behind that as a methodology?
Yeah. How does Conflux work? Is it as good as Sato, basically, is what we're asking.
Sure. Yeah, let's go into the tech details or quick tech overview. So the basic idea of Conflux, if I can zoom out first a bit, was that everyone's been talking about blockchain scalability for the last 1 or 2 years. And some people talk about this scalability trilemma. I think you also wrote an article about the topic.
Yeah. We have our opinions.
Yes. Yeah. So our founders actually believe fundamentally in the validity of this trilemma, which means that given the three desirable aspects, which is scalability, security, and decentralization, you gotta make some trade-offs under certain scenarios because you have hardware constraints. But the main vision was that we are very far from reaching those hardware constraints, actually. We can, using some engineering insights, using some research, we can actually push out the technical, make these public blockchains support much higher TPS. So that's how our founder, Fan Long, started working on in this area. And then we basically tried to apply previous research. I think you guys are familiar with the Ghost protocol. Mm-hmm. And also it was in 2014, published in 2014. And in 2015, the inclusive blockchain protocols, which kind of defined the basis of our protocol. So going into the technical details, when you talk about Bitcoin, one of the problems with Bitcoin is that all the orphan blocks that are discarded as forks, they don't contribute to the safety or the throughput of the system. So what Conflux is trying to solve using a consensus algorithm based on the Ghost protocol is to make all the blocks contribute to both the safety and the throughput of the system. So this way we can have both security and high throughput at the same time.
So, I mean, that's an interesting topic and a couple of things that are dear to our hearts there, mm-hmm. including the insight that the hardware itself isn't really, you know, at its limits by any means in most protocols. But can you give us a little insight into what happens with those, what would traditionally be in a linear chain, orphaned blocks? So how do they get, those transactions get included?
In Conflux, right?
Yeah.
So I mentioned two things, security and throughput. So let's talk about security first. Yeah. The main insight of the Ghost protocol paper was that, because in Bitcoin you use the longest chain rule, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, you have a tree of blocks, right? But within this tree of blocks, you choose a single main chain and mm-hmm. throw away all the other blocks. So these blocks don't contribute to this property of being the longest chain anymore. So what the Ghost Protocol proposed, which is which stands for Greedy Heaviest Observed Subtree, is that instead of choosing the longest chain, we start from the genesis block, and at each block, we choose the heaviest subtree of that block. The advantage of this method is that even if the block is not on the main chain, it will still contribute to the weight of the subtree that it's embedded in. So this way, all the blocks can actually contribute to the security. Yeah, this is important because in Bitcoin, let's say you want to increase throughput, one way would be to have more blocks or larger blocks. And this would lead to more forks. And if you waste a lot of blocks and forks, that will reduce the security of the system. So this ghost approach and the modified ghost approach that we use in Conflux can actually solve this issue.
So I guess I've got a question, which is if we're talking about the difficulty adjustment for mining, because it's mining that's being used to produce blocks, how exactly does that work in terms of adjusting the difficulty of the blocks? You're saying it's the heaviest weight of the subtree. So if the system as a whole, if it doesn't have the visibility of all of the blocks, is the assumption that the system will get visibility into all of the broadcast blocks? Or what I'm kind of trying to mentally wrap my mind around is like, well, the DAG is applying, as I understand it, on the transaction level, right? So you can have two blocks that have, you know, if you have two blocks and one of those blocks has a transaction that's invalid, the rest of the transactions in that block are still going to be okay.
Correct.
So if that's the case, then how are you, I mean, moving back to the difficulty, how is the difficulty actually adjusted?
So that's actually a very good lead-up question to the other aspect of Conflux that I haven't mentioned yet, which is the DAG structure, or this modified DAG structure that we call tree graph. So if we just use the tree like in the simple ghost protocol, then we would have this issue that, okay, at any block, we actually don't have any information about the view of that miner, of the whole structure of the ledger. So to solve this issue and basically to have a more robust ledger, we introduced another kind of edge. So when you create a block, you choose one parent edge, just like in Bitcoin or just like many other protocols. But at the same time, you also can embed multiple reference edges in the block. As a miner, it is your responsibility to reference all the tips of the DAG, of the local DAG that you observe. So basically, this is very nice because it gives you this time relation. We can know that, okay, all the reference blocks must have happened before this block was created. So that is the DAG approach. We actually call it tree graph, which, because in our consensus, we have this DAG of all the edges. But if you only look at the parent edges, that's basically a tree embedded within this DAG. So addressing your other related question about transactions and block validity, this is quite different from Bitcoin and Ethereum in Conflux in that having an invalid transaction within the block doesn't make the block itself invalid. So we strive, we actually keep all the blocks. Of course, we do like basic validation like the hash or timestamp, but we include all the blocks in the ledger. With our protocol, which is the modified ghost, which we call GHAST, G-H-A-S-T, greedy heaviest adaptive subtree, we actually derive a total order of all blocks. So not just the main chain blocks, but all the blocks. And if you have an order of the blocks, then you can derive an order of the transaction. Yep, I think that's basically the overview.
Right, so the thing that occurs to me there is whether or not that's really susceptible to just being spammed to oblivion, because I don't have to create valid transactions. I can just pump out a stream of data at the chain.
I think the really interesting thing is the insight that you can combine proof of work for block production with a DAG structure, so that one of the really interesting use cases is I could be a miner on the side. And I could just mine my own block and add it with my own transactions to the chain at any point. Like that does provide a lot of really interesting scalability, right?
Yeah.
I guess I'm not really clear reading on the material how the difficulty is calculated. Like, how is the difficulty of mining set if people are choosing whether or not they're producing blocks on the side or sort of on what would traditionally be the main chain? And I guess the question I'd have specifically is, with the economic incentives, if someone else produces a block that's at roughly the same time, why don't I steal their transactions and put them into another block that I'm producing if I have significantly more hash power? It's, you know, it's like the economic questions of what are the incentives for the larger miners? Like, do miners actually have a sustainable incentive to permit orphan blocks? And so that's kind of what I was going at with the difficulty one. But
I mean, is there a clearish answer just to the question? I mean, I think that is a really interesting, clear subcase. If I'm collecting transactions of my own somehow, whichever way, and simply want to put them into a block. Now I mine that block, but what determines the difficulty level I need to mine to or mine against?
Well, I think the difficulty level is similar to Bitcoin or Ethereum. We have this kind of dynamic difficulty based on the observed block rate, and we want to keep this block rate constant.
But if it's a DAG, you can't observe all of the blocks necessarily, right?
By using the reference edges, basically each block defines its whole history. So if you use the reference edges and the parent edge and you traverse from one block, the whole DAG, that's supposed to be, if you're an honest miner, that is exactly what you saw when you were mining.
Okay, so if honest miners get a block with a reference, they're basically, they're supposed to go out there and get all of the child blocks that they haven't seen.
They need to,
essentially.
Yeah. It's required for consensus. Mm. Just to address your other question, I think, if I understood correctly, it is true that given that multiple blocks with the same transactions can be included in the ledger, that kind of changes the whole incentive structure. Because in Bitcoin, well, miners have the incentive to include the highest paying transactions in the block. Now in Conflux, that might not work because then all the miners would include the same transactions. But for each transaction, at most one miner can get the fee in Conflux. So I think in our analysis, our miners are more incentivized to have some randomization instead of just choosing the highest paying transactions.
Hmm. What exactly do you mean by that?
It's like you have a transaction pool, right? Every time you start to create a block, you have to choose which transactions you want to include. Mm-hmm. So instead of just choosing the highest paying transactions, you just randomly choose, ideally with some like weight when it comes to the price. But there's some randomization to include, to decrease the probability of conflict with other blocks, competing blocks. And this way miners can maximize their revenue.
Well, I mean, I think one nice thing about it is, as far as the DAG structure goes, one of the criticisms we have of the DAG is it's kind of like, it feels to me in some ways like a step back to Hashcash, where it's, you know, people have bumped into the scaling problem and then they say, well, okay, well, we need to go back to a volunteer network. And, you know, most of the DAGs, they don't specify how people get paid. And they've kind of thrown out the idea that the network does need to pay for itself. So I find the combination really actually interesting, what you guys are doing.
Yeah, it's going to be something I go away and think a bit about, in, like these sort of ideas of the different ways a ledger could be composed this way and how you could build using that, where the use cases would be.
Yeah, although you are wrong about the scalability trilemma I mean, maybe we can get to this. One of the other really interesting things about running into Conflux is it's very much a project, it seems to us, that's rooted in and coming out of Chinese academia. Mm. I mean, maybe Z, could you give us a background on how Conflux got started? You know, the history of the project. We know you guys have raised a lot of money. Is it state supported? Is it private sector supported? Do you know this stuff?
Yeah. I do have a sense of how the project started. So about a year and a half ago, Long Fan and few of his classmates from the Tsinghua Yao class got together and wrote a paper here called Scaling Nakamoto Consensus to Thousands of Transactions Per Second, along with Andrew Yao, which is the only Chinese Turing Award winner. And he's also a dean at Tsinghua University as well. And about a year ago, we actually just celebrated our one-year anniversary yesterday. Long Fan and his group of classmates decided that, you know what, let's not make Conflux only exist in the academic world, only exist in the paper. Let's make this into an actual project and let's change the world. So
hold on. Before we get to changing the world today.
Yes.
So Conflux is coming out of essentially academic graduate student background at Tsinghua.
Yes.
And so it's a group of graduate students who are working in the space.
Yes.
If you see the possibilities of combining DAGs with proof of work. And I mean, I remember it was a couple of months ago, I think, with Andreas, and I was looking up and you guys had raised a really significant amount of funding too. Mm. So is this coming out of academic state support, or are people reaching out beyond the boundaries? Because there is this really interesting partnership you guys have with U of T, which is my alma mater.
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting in the Chinese space, because traditionally a lot of blockchain projects are being pushed by people who really don't have those connections. And so do you know much about this? Can you comment on it? Is this something where like Tsinghua and the government is looking at this saying, yes, this is cutting edge research that we need to support? Are you guys kind of iconoclasts within Chinese academia saying, no, actually blockchain is much more important than people realize? Are you reaching out to industry? And then maybe we can come into where you guys are going now. But because like you guys were a big deal here in China, you know, 3 or 4 months ago. So it's not just the 1 year anniversary, all of a sudden things are pushing forward. Like, who's backing the project?
That's a very dense question. Yeah.
That's a $35 million question right there. Who's backing? So we're actually backed by some of the biggest VCs in the space right now. Some notably one like Sequoia, Baidu, Huobi, Binance, Metastable, etc. And, you know, 80% of our funding are actually not coming from the crypto space, but rather from traditional VC. And, you know, we didn't get state funding or like Tsinghua funding or anything like that. We do like to get to really launch this project into the public space, and especially like go global. We do want to, you know, have the independence-ness of not having the states or the university telling us where we should go, but have our own direction and make this a community-oriented project.
So it's kind of private sector, but high reputation.
Yeah.
And what's happening is sort of Tsinghua University is becoming a sort of feeder hub for projects in the way that Stanford is in the States, if we're going to give people a comparison.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just interested just quickly in between that. So in that year, you know, just some basic stats on the project, like how many people are involved now in terms of employees? And, you know, what's the sort of status in the community? Have you got independent developers working on things? Where are you at?
Yeah, so we have about 50 people in our Beijing office right now, not counting any of our contractors and, you know, our community members, community partners. And what was the other question?
Well, so, I mean, that's the first part. And then in terms of that, developing the community and starting to interact with outside, you know, your partners, etc., where are you at?
Yeah, so we've just recently started to, you know, engage the broad community. We've been laying out down our foundation China already. We have about, you know, 15 WeChat groups and about 8,000 followers on our WeChat channel. Part of the reason why I was hired is because they want to grow their broad community, mainly on like Telegram, Twitter.
You gotta ramp up meme power.
That's right.
Proof of work plus DAG equals that. Photo of something.
Yeah.
Probably The Rock. Something like that.
For The Rock, yeah.
Christmas cake, something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So, yeah, that was sort of getting into one of my next questions, which was, you've obviously, the project has this academic kudos definitely here and also in the US with, you know, Turing Award winner, but how is that translating into getting a Chinese project out, you know, known and recognized outside of China? Is that something you're working on and how's that turning out?
I feel like that'll be one of the biggest challenges we have to face right now. And that's one of the biggest challenges I'm facing right now is aside from China, you know, we have very little, you know, influence or presence. And that is, you know, that definitely does create some barriers from where we want to be when our mainline launches in about 6 months. Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I am, aside from all the memes that, you know, we're preparing,
meme weapons under development.
Yeah. So one of the things that we are actively working on is, you know, going to as many AMAs and interviews with, podcasts such as influential podcasts,
Social.
High audience. Yeah. and you know, just to talk about us as much as possible. And but and another strategy that I just developed last week is by doing cross AMAs with different projects. And you know, because the blockchain space has like how to grow their community in the blockchain space has really changed in the past 2 years. We see like different ways, you know, for, you know, before it was all about like throwing money on, you know, ads on like, you know, CoinMarketCap and stuff. And then it moved on to, you know, getting influencer and KOLs doing YouTube and video and, you know, Medium articles, et cetera. And now we realize that, you know, whoever's in the space already exists in different communities already.
Yeah.
So, you know, and different projects do like want different exposures with other projects.
I think it's also interesting to mention that we do have some international recognition already. One interesting bit was a few weeks ago, like a month ago, the Libra white paper that everyone has been talking about. Actually, Conflux was the only Chinese project and the only DAG project that was mentioned in the white paper. So I think that's kind of an interesting feedback for us.
And the fact that, you know, as a company reputable as Facebook, you know, launching the Libra project, that, you know, we're the only Chinese project that was mentioned there, you know, that does say something about our stance in the international space.
Well, we were disappointed not to see Tron listed.
Tron is officially not Chinese, but nonetheless.
Yeah, so do we want to talk for a bit about going forward? I mean, we've kind of jumped right to marketing as opposed to maybe seeing where you guys see Conflux in the space going forward. I mean, are you going to try to be a cryptocurrency? Are you trying to be more of a data network? Like, you know, getting down to sort of how you guys see the importance. You talked about changing the world a bit earlier. You know, what is it about Conflux that is going to change the world when it gets applied and people are using it at scale?
I think if I can start and then maybe you can add your thoughts. Generally speaking, we at Conflux, I'd say we build on the legacy, not legacy, that's not the right word, but on Ethereum. We really admire what Ethereum has achieved. And Ethereum is a really proven project. So I think many of our goals are kind of similar to Ethereum, but at the same time, it's a new project that has much more freedom to change the protocol. We want to design a system that can provide everything that Ethereum does, but at a much higher scalability. And that would, in my opinion, that would enable a lot of use cases that developers were unable to realize with Ethereum. Like, a lot of dApp developers might have great ideas, but if you have like 10 TPS, that's kind of unfeasible. So one thing that we aspire for is to enable all these dApp use cases that might have been out there, but were unfeasible before.
Essentially, we will achieve what Ethereum tried to achieve, or set out to achieve.
I'm actually curious, outside of the project at Tsinghua University, what your thoughts are on kind of the blockchain ecosystem and how Conflux can or is tapping into it. You know, like one of the, you guys were just talking about like dApp development, for instance. Is there a lot of excitement on application level stuff at Tsinghua?
I mean, I think that is a really key question that we sort of had the big cryptocurrency boom primarily in 2017. How's it looking now for trying to build, you know, the dApp scene and people looking into actual use cases, et cetera, with a little bit less of the hype around?
I mean, I'm assuming you guys, if you're 6 months to mainnet, you're not at the point where, you guys aren't at the point where for Conflux itself, you're like, okay, let's go and see what the initial dApps are. I'm more curious, you know, it's kind of like Libra. We were just at the Asia Blockchain Summit and, you know, going back to Libra, everyone was talking about Libra as a cryptocurrency. And from our perspective, it was kind of ironic because it's the Asia Blockchain Summit, not the Asia Cryptocurrency Summit. And, you know, Libra's snaking between. I think what's really going on is they want to be regulated like Bitcoin. So they're using the language of Bitcoin to describe what's a very different kind of data structure. Yeah. I think Richard was saying in 2017, a lot of the focus in the early hype around cryptocurrencies is that it's a digital asset and that it's money. You know, the dApp thing, Ethereum's sort of big explosive killer app is that we can now give you your own programmable digital currency without even the need for you to do a blockchain. at Tsinghua and Chinese academia, are you seeing people who are people mostly focused on this cryptocurrency aspect to it, or are people getting independently excited about other kinds of applications? Do you have a sense of that?
I think if you talk about academia, like official, let's say, research projects, they don't and they probably cannot like focus on cryptocurrencies because the government's stance is kind of, it makes people confused. It's hard to see whether they support it or are against it. So I think people try to play it safe and focus more on the blockchain side and even like consortium chains that are more like traditional, like, let's say, distributed systems as opposed to disruptive financial innovations.
Yeah, and Xi Jinping, our premier of China, also mentioned a blockchain at the 19th congressional meeting and also the recent national meeting as well. So he does want to move the Chinese high-tech sector into the blockchain space, but he's just not very supportive of cryptocurrency adoption. Hmm. Yeah.
And you feel that, I mean, that's obviously coming right through down to, you know, the coalface as such. So moving on to dApps, have you guys got any partners on board or any people you're working with to sort of experiment on initial dApps and that sort of thing?
Is Conflux going to try to be a digital asset? Is it going to try to be an app platform? If so, where do you guys think it will, its strengths and its advantages will lead it?
Yeah, before we talk about the dApps, you know, I want to talk about like our testnet first, right? So on our testnet, we haven't done any marketing for testnet, nor have we done any, you know, paid incentive model. But we've already got about 1,000 miners from different IP addresses mining on our testnet, which they're mining at a cryptocurrency that has no value after resets and nothing is going to be transferred to the mainnet. So they're all doing it for intrinsic motivations, essentially. Mm-hmm. And we feel like that is the right step into, you know, the mass adoption, you know, for Conflux when it does become mainnet. So, you know, and Peter, do you want to continue on the dApp adoption?
Yeah, I think that we are at the point at this point that we figure out all the research challenges. If you're at most of the engineering challenges, we've basically built the stable foundation and we just need time to finish it. So I think what we're going to see in the next few months is more and more community involvement. We're going to have a bounty program. We're going to involve more and more people for dApp development and such. Do you want to talk about the bounty program maybe?
Yeah, so we are launching a bounty program at the end of the month, which we're looking to really to get the community involved in building the Conflux ecosystem. And part, you know, the different bounty tasks will be, you know, aside from the marketing ones, it will be very like tech related, you know, such as, you know, building smart contracts on the bound, you know, Conflux testnet, for example, that, you know, see how it goes. And, you know, we would ask people to do like bug bounties as well. And, you know, these are kind of efforts that we're putting through to ensure that we do have a healthy and sustainable growth of developer community contributions before our mainnet comes live.
Okay. You actually answered my next question, which was directly around the makeup of what's in those bounties.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
I have a question. How do you guys find it engaging with the international community versus engaging with the Chinese community? Because you mentioned, you know, Sequoia, which has a reasonably strong China presence, and Huobi and Binance, which are Asia focused. What do you find going outside of China and trying to talk to people abroad? Like, I'm imagining that somebody was talking to Facebook at some point, or somebody must have thrown the white paper at them, right? So, I mean, do you get a lot of interactions with people outside of China?
I'd say, actually, our founder went to the Facebook headquarters, I think, 2 weeks ago. I had a technical chat with them, but it's not really, it's more like a chat between experts, not really like marketing kind of talk. I think it's definitely different. I think we have good PR within China. Like, there's a very different approach in China. You use the WeChat official accounts. We release videos. We have like cute stickers and stuff like that. the Chinese style, I think the same approach would probably not work abroad. Mm. And definitely, we've started kind of experimenting and figuring out how to engage the international community more.
Yeah. And we one of the things that I realized is that it's a complete different ballgame, you know, based off of what Peter said, it's a complete different ballgame from, you know, building the Chinese community versus building the broad community. For example, what works, you know, in China, the stickers, in abroad, you know, it's Telegram memes, right? You know, in China, what could work is like free airdrops. What could work abroad is more like bounty, like bug bounties that would get like a little bit more attention. And it's with different target audiences, what they need and how you support them and how you engage them. And, you know, the goals are completely different, and we're still trying to, you know, dive more into that as we go. One of the directions that we are going towards is, you know, really getting our foot into the broad academia sector because of our strong technical foundation. And, you know, based off of that, we do expect to get the technical support from the broad community, and, you know, who will I'm looking forward for them to build exciting and engaging dApps onto our platform once the main outland launches, and that'll be one of the approaches that we'll be going forward with.
Mm. I mean, that's actually, I was just thinking then, it's actually very interesting to hear, because we went to the Stanford Blockchain Conference January, I think it was this year.
February.
And one of the things that struck us coming from China to, I mean, we're at Stanford, so it's going to be a particular crowd, but was how academic and developer focused. I mean, we came away saying, oh, it's ETH Town, because it really, you know, there's a really strong focus on development, particularly in the Ethereum style. Almost everyone we met were Ethereum developers. And there's a real concentration on academics of blockchain and starting from those principles.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the academics are almost justified by their lack of practicality.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like I kind of rag on the BlocksRoute people at Cornell every now and then because I think the economics are wrong. But one of the really positive things that has to be said about that department is they're actually trying to do things that are very meaningful and deploying them.
Yeah.
I didn't get that sense at Stanford. I got like a lot of the research seemed very dry, you know, like if you can find some mathematical 2% extra attack, like that's where you should be putting your time, not on trying to do things like combine DAGs and proof of work to solve foundational problems.
Yeah. So I mean, it is interesting saying that that's actually the approach is to go and hit that academic circuit. Cause I think in many ways, that's probably the right way to hit the US is get that credibility and get support there first, because those things you're saying that the build a community here in terms of like concentrating on like say things like an airdrop, but also just concentrating on that PR driven sort of, I don't know how you put it, but that sort of build a group, build a feeling, build a movement style of promotion may not work as well in the US, but interesting to see how that plays out.
I think what you mentioned, credibility is very a key thing here, especially being a project in China. I imagine that most Western investors or people looking at what's going on in the blockchain space trust the Chinese market less, first of all, because they don't know it well. And second, there are many like, well, not so high quality projects. There are many good projects, but I think there's been a lot of money poured into this market, and a lot of like scam projects might have been here. So what we at Conflux kind of sets us apart is we have a very very high credibility. I think the team, very strong academic background, University of Toronto, CMU, MIT, Tsinghua University, and also very strong engineering background. And I believe that might give the initial legitimacy for many Western observers as of who we are.
Do you guys know IP stuff? Is this something that people in China, high-profile projects, are focused on? At Stanford, it seemed that no one actually cared. It came across in a weird way to us as a bit naive, because, you know, in Asia, like, we can look at Enchain, and, you know, there's a lot of patent activity in the private sector. And I think the open source ethos in the United States in some ways insulates people from thinking that that matters. I mean, in the China space, you guys are exposed to Chinese academia. Is it following the US academic approach? Are people more concerned about getting an IP protective basis? Are they, I mean, do people talk about IP at Conflux?
I mean, as far as I know, we do have four IP registered already. And the reason we're doing, like, Conflux will be open sourced, but the reason we have these IP is so that, for government relations. So that because of the political geography that where we're in, we do have to work with government on some levels. So you know, these IP does secure us good relations with them to help to facilitate the conversation.
To say we're an inventive Chinese project, or
to really make a statement that our IP are registered in China rather than states or other places to gain karma points or brownie points or however you like to call it.
Double prove you're innovating and that you're dedicated to the local infrastructure.
I'm actually kind of curious about a deeper point, which I've always been surprised that there aren't more, that the Chinese big tech titans aren't more aggressive about reaching out into the American IP space. You know, especially in blockchain and especially in a community where American companies and developers seem very, very naive about the need to get some sort of protective barrier.
Particularly when, I mean, I know from contact with the Chinese broader startup scene, not specifically blockchain, that, you know, there's almost a paranoia about being copied and outmaneuvered, even though you're a first mover with an idea. So I think that's an interesting question to me, whether that plays on people's minds at Conflux as well, that there's a sense of, oh, maybe someone will just fork our network and run off with it.
I personally don't think public chains have to worry about the issue of, forking. Like somebody, forking our codes and creating their own Conflux 2.0 or whatnot is, as when they do that. So before Conflux, one of the projects I did work with was Nebulous. So, their statement was like, they're not worried about forking because if somebody does the fork their network and decide to implement their own updates, then Nebulous will already be three steps ahead. They will already have, three other soft forks and three other updates before, the fork does the initial fork.
Yeah, but like, is that actually real? That's something people say. It's kind of like, we're not gonna dig the gold up ourselves. We're going to sell pickaxes to miners. And that attitude missed Bitcoin completely in Silicon Valley, because instead of actually, you're multiplying probabilities of failure. I don't know. I mean, it might be true. It might not be. I think there's a lot of stuff like that that's taken for granted in the States. I guess I was just asking, trying to get a sense in China of, if Conflux is going to be a major, major Chinese project, does it have international ambitions beyond just trying to be a China-centered blockchain? And if so, does that mean that you guys see IP as an avenue for that? I think it's going to be really interesting what happens when the Chinese tech titans start trying to muscle their way into the American market and new emerging areas like blockchain, where they can get a foothold in some important IP, I think is going to be one of the first ways they can get in. Like, it's not Amazon that's taking out blockchain patents.
That's true.
I think the US is behind the times on this. But anyway, that's maybe that's a discussion. Maybe a discussion over beer. But is there anything you guys would like to tell listeners about Conflux? Kind of communicate, how can people who are listening help, is one of the questions we like to ask. Because there's often a chasm, and people who are in America or Canada or Europe, like, if they really like a project, are there opportunities for them to get involved?
Right now, I think we are very eager to welcome everyone to join and help us, or just take a look at what we're doing. So, of course, our code is already open source on GitHub. If you're more technically inclined, you can take a look. Also, as Joe mentioned, the testnet is live, so anyone can join and mine for some testnet coins, just for fun. And we are very excited to people joining our bounty program, as mentioned, next month. I think that's probably a very good way to get involved. And also, we're on Telegram, Twitter.
Yeah, These are, and we're going to be active on Reddit starting next month as well. And aside from, you know, I would encourage everybody to join our bounty program to score some sweet free Conflux tokens. We also would invite everybody to join our community as well. You know, could be either from a community contribution or from, you know, the team itself. You know, if you're based in Beijing and you do want to join the Conflux team, please send us an email or, you know, shoot me a message on Telegram and Twitter. And we're very open to hiring very talents in the space.
Okay, cool. Perfect. Well, guys, thanks a lot for coming in. And hopefully we'll have you on in a future show, maybe in a year or so, when we can see the network in action as it slowly begins to clobber California.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks for having
me. You can get in there through Sequoia and then just latch on and put them in the death shape. You know?
Yeah. Cool.
Okay. Well, Z, Peter, thank you guys very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you guys very much.